Well, a number of you have been here either yesterday or the day before or both, so even there's some sense of continuity to these sessions and yet some sense of each one being independent from one another. But before we move in to talking about competition and exploring that further, and I really look forward to that, I thought we'd back up just a bit, and I put on the board what we'd put on the board on Monday, and that is a sense of pedagogical learning, child-like learning, and adult learning, which Malcolm Knowles calls andragogy, which we might call anthropagogy if we wanted to be inclusive. But anyway, the concept adult learning, that pedagogical learning is characterized by being dependent, directed, transmissive, subject-centered. Experience is defined as that which happens to us. We're more dependent again. And the self-concept is that of student. Who are you? I'm a fifth grader. That kind of thing. Whereas most adults, if you say, who are you? You don't say, I'm a Sunday Bible class attender. I mean, you know, there's other points to their life than that. And adult learning characterized by independent or interdependent. There's a mutuality of learning. Learning is problem-solving centered, and therefore Alan Tuff's concept that 70% of adult learning is invisible because it's problem-solving centered and people are about it all the time, even though they don't sign up for classes. Experience is defined as who we are, and the self-concept is adult in society. Now, it's not true that adults do not engage in pedagogical learning. This morning, I had my first turn at doing dishes. And it could have worked that we would have done that in an andragogical way, because all of us in that kitchen had done dishes before, and we could have had a mutuality of learning and so on, problem-solving centered. Obviously, we had to get the dishes done. But it was directed learning. There was someone in charge who told us what to do. And that, quite frankly, was comforting. It was time-saving. I mean, we might still be there if we were all, you know, learning in an andragogical way. Somebody said, would you please do these over here? And we did. How? Here's what you do. You know, you do it this way. And it was fine. Now, we were adults. We were not treated as children. If through attitude, through tone of voice, there'd been a kind of, you probably never done this before, you don't know how to do it kind of concept, I think the pedagogical learning for the adult would not have worked. There was affirmation. Remember a couple days ago we said that invitation, example, affirmation kind of litany to learning. There was affirmation that we'd done it well. And that felt good. Even though we were simply doing pots and pans, to be told we'd done the job well, felt good. And there was respect. So there's a place for pedagogical learning in adults' lives. But for the most part, I think adults thrive when learning is more in this column. And I think this place is very much that way. I mean, the fact that we are treated with equal respect, even though we come from different strata of society. We come with all different pedigrees and titles and names and job descriptions and whatever. We are treated with a mutuality of respect, and where we are expected to be quiet at certain hours, expected to learn, expected to come, expected to do our chores, and it works. It really works. You can imagine with just a little twist of attitude, a little punitive, even a little humor that punitive, if you don't do this or that, something's going to happen, how we react as adults, huh? But that respect and that mutuality really does work. Again, many of you were here yesterday or the day before, and some of you just came in for the first time this morning. But we've been trying to do our learning here in an andragogical way, adult learning way. And yesterday, I think we worked hard together. And we went apart, and I have a feeling that we weren't done. When learning is transmissive, lecture type, yeah, get all the notes down, close your book, you're done. Don't think about it till the next day. But the kind of turning on, the open-endedness of adult learning is not neat. can make some people very uncomfortable. Well, I didn't really get my money's worth. I don't have my notepad full of notes here. And it isn't nicely done. You can't say, I finished point four, number, you know, D. Some things may have turned on in you since yesterday. Just as I was thinking about learning styles and doing dishes this morning, I'm curious if any of you had some other things that came to mind after we were together yesterday in regard to what your job teaches you, what you do all day teaches you, and how the sense of vocatio meets that, or how the Christian sense of vocatio meets that. That's kind of the point where we left one another. That doesn't mean our learning was done, but that's where we, the gathered community, became the scattered community, and we went apart from each other. Did anything, was there anything cooking in your head since yesterday that you think we might share together on that?
You just pulled together something for me, what came up yesterday, frustrations in some of my jobs, and particularly the last one I had, was that because of the number of turnover of volunteers and paid staff, and kind of the job where the learning was more of the anthropological or whatever.
Yeah. Adult learning style, yeah.
It was very frustrating for me because it meant that people were doing so much time learning that not very much of actually doing the job took place. And I find that for me, sometimes I am happier working in places where it is not that kind of orientation, because I feel like I accomplish more and make more of a contribution. And I get frustrated. I mean, for a year it's fine, but I find I never work any place longer than 2 or 3 years because of constantly having to repeat that learning process with new people who come in. It's no longer fresh for me.
That's interesting. Very interesting. I'm glad that kind of pulled together that way. Yeah. Anybody else have some pieces?
I can relate something that you mentioned just this morning. We were planning a trip to Europe, so I took a German course. And the instructor was a very good instructor, but she treated us like kindergartners.
Yeah. You are not a kindergartner.
No,
you're not 5 years
no.
old. Sometimes just the turn of voice can do it. Our different roles. I'm a professor in Dubuque. Last week I was a PhD student in Denver. Different role. And it's interesting. A staff person in Denver treated me a way it would never have in Dubuque. with just a different voice. I was asking to find a catalog in a certain room. I was in the wrong room. And I felt really stupid. And I thought, why am I feeling stupid? It was the tone of voice. Probably she has been treated as a child in a hierarchical system, and she as an adult needed someone else to treat as a child. And I was the one. And I thought, why do I feel so bad? Yeah.
Something that came up from yesterday, that I teach in the university, and I deal with students of all stages, from beginners at the university through doctoral students. I've been thinking about how much more gratifying it is to teach the graduate students. And one thing that you mentioned is that perhaps we just see too little of the undergraduates who we see for maybe one semester, and in one of those big lecture classes, you don't really get to know them, but the graduate students hang around for several years. You deal much more closely with
in
them.
In and out of the classroom.
In the other kind of way, too, and especially a PhD student ends up teaching me something.
Yeah, that mutuality begins to happen, and that's exciting, huh? Because you're growing, too.
But I think that same argument came from the university of Duke for, it seems like, half of my life. And we discussed that one back and forth many times about the difference between teaching an undergraduate class and a graduate class. And seems to be, for me, it comes right down to the fact that a graduate student has more or less transferred into the adult learning stage, while an undergraduate student, in many of their beginning years at least, are still in the youth, the childlike learning stage. And in some sense, a graduate student, for many graduate students, you really have to just direct, stand out of the way and let them learn themselves. There's not that much teaching that has to take place for graduate students, where undergraduate students still have to be taught. And there was always a great conflict between those who taught graduate students and those who taught undergraduate students. I mean, who's really doing the teaching here and who's allowing the learning to happen?
Yeah.
Another twist to that from a student's point of view, when I went back to get my fifth year after being out of college for, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 9 years, I couldn't believe the difference from a student's point of view. When I went did my undergraduate regular college, it seems like I was mainly taking courses to get the grade, you're taking classes to pass, you're taking classes that you had to take to get a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Some of them you learned and you got interested and excited about, but most of them you just took because you had to.
Self-concept student.
When I went back, I took classes because I wanted to learn something. And I couldn't believe the difference. I mean, I really didn't care that much about a grade. I hoped to maybe get an A or B just because that would have been nice. But I did it because I wanted to learn about that thing. And it just made all the difference.
But nobody could turn you off.
Oh, yeah. It was just exciting. And in fact, I told one of my professors that I had always done terrible in history. I was awful with remembering dates and things like that. But I took a Washington State history class when I moved from Minnesota. And I took it because it was really fun to find out about the background. And I told them that people shouldn't be allowed to go to college till they live for 5 or 6 years, you know, doing something else, because it just makes all the difference in how you learn.
Pedagogy
is... I'm sure that makes a difference on how the professors...
If a professor can look through eyes and enjoy that, it's very threatening. Just as you described, it can be fun to learn from your student. There are some teachers who cannot do that. That is very threatening and very scary. But on the other side of it, pedagogy is habit forming. And there's something very, it'd be nice just to be kind of told all the time. And it sometimes, as you said a while ago, that's very helpful. It saves time to do it, because it takes a lot of energy to have all this motivation. One way that we can trip ourselves up, sometimes we think we're teaching in this mode when we're working with adults. We think we're inviting them to bring all that they are, but we're asking what I call guess what I'm thinking questions. You know what I mean? Fill in the blanks of my mind. We really just interrupt our own lecture with those kinds of questions and have them fill in the blanks of our mind and call that discussion. I'm not sure that really is. Those are deathly, those guess what I'm thinking questions. You already know what I mean, so I won't give examples.
I think the Skull magazine is like that. Fill in the blanks.
The blanks.
Yeah, the
Bible says something like that. Fill in the blanks. The other night at our forum on Hiroshima, one simple question, he had three. He only used one. And it was profound where we got. We started out kind of at this level, and where we got was profound. Because all of that was inside all these people in this room. On the other side, sometimes people work very hard filling in the worksheets, and it's not profound at all. Yeah. So how... Yeah, go ahead.
I just thought of something having to do with the church situation. A pastor who... to me, is speaking to the people as if he's speaking to children, you know, and has notes and all that sort of thing. And you get kind of caught in a rut, and although a lot of people seem to enjoy it, that it's that new Christian, I'm getting a little tired of it, and I'm just wondering, and since I'm not in the same denomination that most of you are, I don't think it will bother me.
Well, that sure doesn't happen in Lutheran, don't
it? But I'm just wondering... what you could do to change that or help for a pastor to see that he's doing that, you know, the difference between teaching and preaching, and I guess that depends on the individual, but then the two ways of teaching.
We teach often in the way in which we've been taught, or else we react to it and do something entirely different. And much of higher education has still been pedagogical. And there's something, it's, you know, keep going for yourself to keep it in that mode. I think an adult education program in a Christian community can be all sorts of things. And perhaps one track that is like that is very helpful. But then some other small group thing, or some mutuality of two or three leaders leading a different way, or no leader, getting some other kinds of things going for those people at their level. We do a congregation no good at keeping everyone at the same level, because adults are not at the same place. They're all over the place. I've got some other stuff here with me that maybe I can share with you, okay? That might be useful. Are we, okay,
like
go ahead.
So much of our time in our work, you know, we can know our skills and our topic, you know, but it seems like so much of our time and energy is in the interaction, and consume when you find that you're going to conflict with someone else's value system. For instance, I'm in a small cooperative, and we've been advised by a small business administration, you know, you're a business, therefore your goal is to have your prices as high as you can, and to make as much money as you can. On the other hand, you're interacting with 13 other members, and you know their problems, you know that their kids, their children are there, they're having difficulty in the marriage. How much time then should we give to control? Or if there's one who's not cooperative, because all these bylaws, et cetera, they're taking a lot of time, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I can spend our group's money the way I think it should be spent. So, how much should one give themselves to this individual? How much should one of them give themselves to the individual's lives rather than pursuing our business? It's these kind of conflicts take up my energy by more than my work.
No,
see, business is 95% people and 5% business.
Yeah.
I think that's
true. It's really true. I mentioned Bill Deal, and I want to read from him in just a moment, who's written a lot about that kind of thing in Christianity and Real Life. Is that his book, Christianity and Real Life? Very useful. It's probably in the library here, I'm guessing. Talking a lot about that. And when you move over the sphere, it gets more complex. Not easier. And then even how much time do you spend together in an adult class on Sunday morning, you know, when you get, there's so many things, it's open-ended. And how much care.
How much should one give themselves outside of their work to be the support, be the encouragement, be the one good idea, and how much then or should you expect to have a lot of that from the group yourself?
Mm-hmm.
It's to me that balance is always the issue. You know, it's easy to stand for other people for their needs.
And you need to be fed also.
Yeah, and then at what point could you say you're being taken advantage of so that your time and energy is going to be their support rather than to your own work and your own
That's an important question. I kind of maybe we can talk some more later too on that, because I'd like to. The whole thing of, I don't think it does people in the end much good if finally you are drained, or if I am drained and can give no more. I mean, God has created us to be mutually independent, to be the body of Christ, to feed and to be fed. Otherwise, I mean, if you are emaciated because you've been feeding others, no, it can happen. Yeah. Should we move on? I know some of you came specifically today to talk about competition and its role in learning. Okay? I'm going to do some transmissive stuff for a few minutes, hop over into this column, and there'd be a chance for you to change gears and be thinking about competition as a learning style, one, from your own experience of learner, and two, from your experience of teacher, because you've all been teachers in one setting or another. We've probably been teachers in lots of settings. The one chapter in my book that I didn't want to write, because I don't like that teaching style to use, it's not my favorite style, but I needed to write it, and I'm going to read a section from it, is the one on confrontation and clarification, or we could have said confrontation and competition. So let me just read a section here. Most 6th and 7th graders were stricken with fear by the tales told of Mr. Withers' 8th grade class. His loud voice and demanding manner hid his compassionate heart. He expected results of his students and tested their endurance. He challenged their statements, forcing them to stand up for their opinion. They were confronted with opposing ideas. they were confronted with Mr. Withers. After young Brian had recounted his understanding of the explanation of the first article of the Creed, Mr. Withers informed me in a tone of unchallengeable authority that God could not be both all-knowing and still care about the individual. Mr. Withers confronted Brian with slashing questions. What about those villagers killed last week in an earthquake? Did God love them? If so, why didn't he prevent that catastrophe? Had God caused it? Brian, overwhelmed by that probing adult voice, could not respond. When Mr. Withers demanded he must answer, Brian felt tears coming. He wondered how he could leave the classroom to cry in the bathroom where none of his classmates would see him. Brian made it through that class and through the year. He survived Mr. Withers, but we're left wondering why Mr. Withers taught that way. Did he enjoy it? Was he copying a teaching style he had experienced as a student? Did he take pleasure in being known as a hard teacher? There are students and teachers who seem to thrive on confrontation and debate. For others, these are not comfortable learning styles, perhaps even degrading. But whatever one's reaction, confrontation is a memorable teaching style. There comes a time when all of us have heard all that we have heard, all that we've learned, discussed, experienced, is confronted by another person, by another ideology, or by our own lifestyle. This may be difficult, painful, even devastating, but it is powerful learning. There is learning that takes place through competition, and some people believe that the only real valid learning happens through competition, whether it's competition for grades, and the teacher sets it up that way, and the motivation all year is for grades. Get to that end line, get that A, get that A. There are teachers who teach in such a way that one is competing through being confronted by questions head on. You've got to get prepared for the hard, cold world. Nurturing is for kindergartners. You love them the first year, but you've got to grow up, and that means being ready for a competitive society. I had a man in our home congregation who, in a parents' meeting, said, "Well, confirmation instruction on Wednesday night won't work for our family because my child also needs to be engaged in volleyball practice. It's time for him to learn to stand up for himself, to be able to compete and win. Confirmation is nice, but this is important." Somehow, well, I don't need to fill in the blanks of that. Bill Deal, in his book, Thank God It's Monday, has a couple of chapters on our competitive society. Before the meal begins, the chaplain of one of our service academies is called upon for the invocation. This is the prayer. O you who threw out that first forward pass into the universe and called it earth, may we always remember that it is more important to be on your winning side than it is to win without you. Let us huddle with you daily, get our plays for our lives, move the ball in accordance with your will, and put it across the goal line for your sake. To you, our quarterback and coach, we give thanks for this event and the food we are about to receive. Okay. And then there's a number of pages on the acceleration of competition in sports in our society. It's neat to have you here, Joanne. And I know that there's been a corresponding, well, maybe not corresponding move, but a movement in our society for non-competitive games or for win-win kind of games. And I'm guessing that some of your conversation will want to center on that. But a quote from Deal. I've read studies which suggest that participation in competitive sports, especially contact sports, makes people more aggressive in all aspects of their lives. Other studies indicate that it is simply that naturally aggressive people find their way into competitive sports. So one could say, you know, does being formed in a competitive learning style, whether it's sports or academia, make one aggressive, or is competition a way of responding to what is inside human beings, and that is a competitive urge? The other night we asked, is aggression conquer, or do we use it in lieu of sports? Or is that whole, and here we come up with feminine masculine worldviews, or is it that the whole male mode of society for centuries has led us to a militaristic view of society? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg kind of question? At what point do sports stop serving us and start possessing us, Deal asks. I might not use the term sports there because I would rather use the term competition. At what point does competition stop serving us and start possessing us? He goes on then to have a whole section on business. And those of you whose daily lives are in the hardcore business world know the competition there. High achievers in business today get their kicks from being part of a winning organization, to be on the winning team. Or, you know, you've got to make it to the top. Be number one is one of the important creeds of American civil religion. Next week we're going to talk more about American civil religion per se, but this dovetails a bit. The question is competition working for us, or are we working for it? And to translate back into learning styles, and the question is the adult learner. Do we need to learn to be competitive to be adult? Or is there an alternative? Important kind of questions. Bertrand Russell once said, "I do not think that ordinary human beings can be happy without competition. For competition has been, ever since the origin of man, the spur to most serious activities." Remember the other day when we defined adulthood? To be an adult would be to be serious, to be responsible. And many people would say that means to be competitive by definition of human beings. Well, sports, business. Some say, we'll escape. We'll go to the field of fine arts. One of my sons is in the field of fine arts. you know how many people, quotes, make it to the top, and if you don't make it to the top, you're going to have to teach, for heaven forbid. You know. Okay. Religion? Too often the best clergy are those who can pack them in on Sunday morning and keep them happy and balance the budget. A bishop, LCA bishop out east once told me, we talk a lot about pastors in servanthood and whatever, you know, it's God's people wherever you go, but he says, I have yet for a pastor to ask me as bishop for a call in a smaller church with a lesser salary. It was Henry Clay who said, of all human powers operating in the affairs of humankind, none is greater than that of competition. We still have country fairs with awards for best apples, best corn, best poultry, best pigs, best apple pie, you name it. If you don't have a blue ribbon for something, it's because you just haven't tried. Out there somewhere, there's a blue ribbon or an award or a first place awaiting you. Just go and get it. Competition is one of the powers which Christians must deal with. And then he goes on with a whole chapter on the dark side of competition. Competitive society presents us with dilemmas galore. And some of the struggling that you're alluding to, I'm sure, is the result of people living in a competitive society. Clearly identifying winners may help develop leaders. But there are what happens to the losers, of course, is the question. What happens to us when we lose? What happens to us if we are C students? What happens to us if we're only so-so? What you started it with a while ago. Deal says that there's one type of competition which virtually has no effect on others, and that's competing with oneself. And many people say, well, I'm not going to compete with him. I'll compete with myself. Someone at the dinner table yesterday said, that's the most devastating of all. And as we discussed further, it was clear because the enemy, the competition is never gone if the competition is yourself and all our life. So how do you come to terms with the other self of you who is your competitor? Would be another question to raise. Should the Christian refuse to participate in a win-lose competitive situation? Is it possible, in adult learning concepts, for a Christian to live non-competitively in our society? Are we absolutely naive? Or is that even what God calls us to do? If God calls us to an incarnational vocatio, calls us to live our life in the world, then maybe God calls us to deal with competition. Again, maybe the social sciences have taken this head on. Bert brought me a tape yesterday, successful negotiating. You know, maybe Christians have just been afraid to even talk about the subject. We don't give gold stars anymore in Sunday school. That's not what we do here. Well, an important question. How does competition shape us? Deal pushes it further in saying, what are the fruits of a competitive system? He says, greed. Where do you stop? He calls for a de-escalation of our competitive society. Sounded very much like a de-escalation of the arms race. And you say, how are you going to do that? And where do you start? We need to be aware of the effect that competition has on others and has on our own self-identity. Jesus lived and moved in a competitive society just as we do, but he was not hooked by the powers of competition. He did not need to compete. Okay, done with transmissive kind of stuff. Where are you at in this? We've shaped some of the questions. Is competition necessary? Is it necessary to become an adult in our society? How does competition shape us? Are there learning styles? You know, I didn't want to write that chapter in here, but are there at least one of eight facets of learning styles that are healthy ones? Debate, competitiveness. How do you handle that? Okay. Can you all hear her with the bowling alley? That's not bowling? That's wood chopping wood. Can you all hear with the wood?
They're stacking wood.
They're stacking
wood. Laying up wood.
Can you talk a little louder?
Okay. But I know in elementary school, you meet competition always everywhere, everything. And it can be used in good ways.
What are some boundaries to that? What are some
deal with it differently? Children deal with competition, just like adults do. But I don't know, but I see a last year we had a little reading competition. I teach deaf children, and their reading is very poor, and they have to be really encouraged, even more than other children, to read. And because we have varying degrees and ability to read in our group, we had made a big chart. You know, and some lines were longer than others, but some people had, you had to get your little rocket to the end of the, to the moon, you know, by the time school was up. Well, some of the kids really took to that very well and really worked on it and would come in every Monday morning having read three books with little reports written. And one of our very best readers, whose line was all, you know, was about third from the longest, read one book all year. It obviously wasn't his thing. I mean, he didn't care about the competition. And we had three other kids who were just driving, and every morning we would be out there counting how many books that they had read and who was ahead and all that kind of thing. And then we have the same kind of competition in games and sports. Some kids are terrible losers. Just cannot deal with being on the team that loses. And that's something we have to get to learn how to lose in life.
That's, that's very helpful. I'm going to write on an imaginary board over here because I don't write well and listen at the same time. So I'll just write over here.
Somebody,
but yeah, important thing that I want to hold up for my learning this morning is, just as we talk Monday about individual differences of adults, the individual differences of how helpful competition is in my own learning style, and yes, indeed, for children to help them own their learning styles that work for them, and how competition is helpful or harmful to them. I think one can do that at a very early age. As a teacher, if one is saying you all have to get to the moon by the end of the year with your rockets, that's helping, that's making students fit your mold, in your mold. It's useful. Some other things here you've been thinking about. Yeah.
How do you deal with yourself if you don't want to compete?
Put some more to that. What's competition meant for you? Not a helpful mode for you. Can you respond?
I was going to ask the same question, thinking about, I have two daughters who are about as opposite as they can be. And one, if she saw that, you know, charge situation would be, oh wow, let's go. The other one would say, I'm not sure I can do it, so I don't think I'll try. You know, we'll get scared to death of lists and things like that. You know, and of course you think inside yourself that you treat your children basically the same, you know, that you raise these kids in the same family and that you don't. And yet, how much are people just born with? You know, as infants, are they born with either they're competitive or they aren't? Because, you know, here we've got two such opposites. And I, when you asked that, I was, in my head, I was thinking the same thing, but with my kids. You know, one doesn't, one doesn't.
Yeah, what's wrong with somebody, you know, not just liking you because you're Audrey, not because you do this?
I kind of feel that we're born with a certain competitive instinct to improve, to gain strength, you know, to learn. That doesn't mean that we destroy other people through intervening. And I think there's that competition that we talk about, the sport, you've got to win it every time. But there's that competition of gaining strength for excellence and for improvement and for understanding, for seeing more deeply, to gaining insight. That Bill endorsed the other day when he said, and we should use our gifts to become what we can become, and not at the expense of destroying others, or to make them feel like they are. But if we don't, try to learn, understand, gain, and grow, then I feel we stop the control and we're dying.
If a goal is that we become, I think we'd agree on that here, all that we can be, that God has created to be, and that we've been redeemed to be, is competition a tool toward that? And for some it is, and maybe for some it isn't.
That
is
the competition.
That is
if you set up that you are going to do the best you can to become the best you can for God, that is a form of competition.
That's the race right
there. Say more. I'm not sure I'm understanding or agreeing.
Well, don't
I'm
lose what you were.
That as soon as you have set up a goal, you then become competitive. Just the concept of, even if the goal is to be the very best I can for God, that is a form of competition. It is competition that you will cooperatively work with God, or cooperatively work with people. But by definition of what competition is, and so it may be a positive approach to dealing with God. This may mean that some pursue it and it looks like competition. She may pursue it, feeling it a non-competitive way of reaching her gift to God. So that as soon as you put a label on what it is you're doing, which is I'm going to be do the best, as soon as you put the word best I can, that's a competitive word. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have it in our vocabulary
in the sense of
good, better, best. To say I am going to be a child of God is one thing. To say I'm going to be the best child of God is another, is competitive.
Go ahead.
Maybe in the sense of competence, but competition seems to imply better than someone else.
I'm going to write some things on the board here. Broadening definition of, I hear you saying, of competing mean any time, broader definition, working toward a goal and related to competence. What you were saying a moment ago is competing much narrow in destructive sense to the point of destroying somebody else.
I was talking about goals, you know. There is that destruction where in order to destroy the other person so they will look good, not because you have
which has to do with self-identity, and I think as you define it, it would not have to be that at all. Helping so that the identity of you and you are also affirmed.
It's the labels we put on the word competition within our Western society. The Eastern society doesn't have any trouble with, they don't need to deal with the word competition in a lot of ways because as long as it's non-threatening, they consider it non-competition. As soon as it's threatening, then it is competition. And so I don't think one is born so much with being competitive or not competitive, what we're born with is survival instincts, which may or may not lead us to competitive. And then, from the moment the blue booties or the pink booties arrive, then the definition of what is competitive changes. So that we see a male definition of what is competitive, but the fact is the female has her own agenda, which is maybe in the pleasing stage, that's a competitive kind of thing, but I am getting my gifts of God for that. It's just a whole broad term that competition does not have to be a bad, if there is a value judgment word, but when you're using it as competence and not against something.
What term would we have then? If we broaden competition, then do we have another term that talks about the problem that we have in our society, which then essentially says, I only know that I'm good if I compare myself to someone else.
Well, we have a word in sport, which is athletics, which makes it the highly competitive feeling. I don't know.
But I think he's asking for a negative
a word
term, a word that could just maybe destructive competition. You want to jump in?
The way that one relates to competition as an individual or as a group, I think has a great deal of difference. I'm thinking of a wise teacher or even coach is interested in bringing out the best in each individual, whether in a class or a team or whatever. Generally, let's say it's a sports team, this will also be good for the collective group. But we see, I think what we're complaining about with competition so much is when it's just the goal of the group that becomes the crucial thing. And if you can't contribute to that out, that kind of attitude.
A while ago, when we had this prayer in here, we chuckled a bit of God. Maybe the sense of God is coach. There are many names for God. One name for God might coach not be bad. A good coach. I recall one time visiting a church in which we were just kind of there for the afternoon. There was two people on the basketball court of this church, and two players out there. And the one was really hogging the ball. I mean, really hogging the ball from the other. Wanted to make the basket all the time, and I found out later that was the intern. I thought, oh, good grief, that somehow a coach or the player that always has to be the one that can only see what my own needs met, is not a good coach, is not a good team leader or whatever. A coach would not want such competition that the members of the team would destroy each other. That wouldn't be good for the team. And I suppose within a league, a good coach would not want their players to win so badly that all the other teams in the league would be destroyed. Now, I want to say something just about this being born with and see how you react to this. We are born good creatures, and we are sinners, and we are both sinner and saint. And I think it's very helpful in our Lutheran theology to have that perspective. Because the two get mixed up a lot. I mean, I think God created us to grow developmentally. It wasn't the developmental theorists who discovered, maybe they discovered it, but God created us that way all along. So I believe that there is an element of, if we call it competition in that broader sense of the term, to grow and be all that I can be, that is very biblical, very biblical. There is also very much within me, whether I do it with my pink booties on or somebody's blue booties on, I might do it more manipulatively, indirectly, nicely please, as a woman, but to do the other one in. I mean, that is the sinner of me that really would like to make me God over my own world and, be God over you, please. And that means not only to win, but there's a part of me that would want to destroy even that which I love most dearly. Each of us knows that, we're in touch with that. And both of those at work in there, I think, kind of get mixed up in we have discussions in the competition. You've all felt that drive at some time, haven't you? Not just to go beyond and really kill. That's there, whether we're playing sports or not playing sports at all. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was thinking that, how competition can be good or bad. I'm the individual competitor. Everything I do, I still remember my dad telling me, whatever you're going to do, if you're going to do it at all, do it the best. Don't go half.
If it's worth doing, it's worth doing.
Yeah, if it's worth doing, if we're doing it well. And I can just see myself hearing him say that and doing things better. And so to a point that I think to myself, well, I can do it this way, or I can really learn about it and really put some time into it and make it the best. And so up to that point, the competition with myself has been good, and I do that all the time. It's when I end up with this project, then I'll think, well, let me look around and see who, you know, mine's better than that. Or I'm glad I did it this way, because look how much. And I think it's at that point that my competition becomes the negative aspect. But I think up to that point, I mean, I like competing with myself and thinking, well, I'm going to do it the best. I want to be the best for me, not compare.
Maybe there's even a point at which, let me even redeem part of that, there's even a point at which to look around and say, hey, I did it. I can weave just like she can weave. I'm going to destroy her weaving because I might have to be better is another thing. But I think sometimes we take the side of Christianity which is not the suffering, which is the suffering servant of Christ, but which is kind of wallowing in our own, how bad I am. Much has not been done in this world by Christians because we go and say, oh, poor, terrible me. I'm not sure God created or redeemed us for that. So there is a point at which to look around and compare. I can. I have gifts. That other step beyond, I'm kind of playing with your words a bit, in which, good for me, I'm kind of God and they're nobody.
Suppose
what
we would hope
for is to
rejoice with the other person that they have succeeded, maybe more, you just have to rejoice in their success, and that's really difficult. That sometimes harder than suffering with the suffering, huh? Yeah, to rejoice with the rejoice. Yeah, that's true. <laughs> On the other hand, the herd having achieved that excellence, those who have been working and struggling on that same project, then can see a result, and can be an inspiration to know that this is possible, and they can use that information or see the result, and it's enrichment for them to, you know, if there's this much more material to draw on, to see how the solution can be handled.
Otherwise, a Christian should never be a winner. And there are a lot of us who spend our lives trying to trip ourselves up so we're never winners. So we have a kind of distorted view of Christianity in that sense. We're broadening the subject here, but
I don't know, maybe Elmer, where you have the book that it's in, where they talk about Jacob's ladder and Sarah's circle.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
I think that is maybe a concept, because we can't find a word, of sort of the difference that occurs, whether I'm really climbing or I am cooperatively competing with the world in how I'm dealing. It's some of the feminist movements are trying to do a Sarah Circle.
Instead of the Jacob's Ladder.
And not trying to be climbing up. But the fact is they have a very difficult time from the Western society because from childhood up, even though we're in two different cultures of men and women, we really still have the common culture of competition, whatever that word is. But somehow if we see in our heads the difference between this and that, it is a concept that can help in the Christian orientation. You have the same problem even in the church, where the top goes here and the philanthropic kinds of reformers are in a circle.
Once one has tasted partnership, can you imagine in your mind the time that good partnership has really happened and tasted it, you long for it. Once one has felt the strength of Sarah's circle, rather than the stepping on someone in order to get ahead. Once one has tasted a different way of working on a committee, some folk, even on committee, well, maybe particularly on committees, it is my idea wins, and your idea loses. I teach church administration. To be part of some of these task forces for the new Lutheran church, yes, we've dealt with quotas, huh? To have more equal numbers of male, female, and to have, particularly one I'm working on now, a female chairing it, very highly charged issues. The bishop, what to do with seminaries, lots of highly charged issues. I have heard people say, boy, they should have been fighting on that committee. And I'll say, no, I'm on that committee. There hasn't been. They're projecting their ideas of what they thought we'd be doing. Powerful people, really powerful people, working together at things, in a cooperative way, in a creative way, and moving ahead. And that stress that you talked about a while ago. We'll sit down and everyone and say, it was fun. It was fun, and we came up with more than any of us could have alone, and certainly more than if I'd been using all that energy to outmaneuver you with what you probably wanted. So if you've tasted playing, really playing your heart out in a game which is not all for you've got to kill the other people, and felt the body and felt the sense of just being fatigued together, somehow the other isn't as satisfying anymore, I believe. Go ahead.
I'd like to share a little experiment that has been very meaningful to me. It was done down in California where they took two groups of 9-year-old boys and they brought them two at a time into a room and they gave them a rope with a knot in the middle of it, and they brought in the United States boys and they also had some Mexican boys. They brought in the United States boys and said, there's a line on the floor and a knot in that rope, and you take that, and every time you get that knot to pass over that line, you get a dime. On your marks, get set, go. And they just pulled for all they were worth, and that knot kind of went back and forth several times as they gave it all they had. And then they brought they said, okay, you get 50 cents. They brought the Mexican boys in and put them on each end of that rope, and they said the same thing. Every time you get that knot to pass over the line, you get a dime. On your marks, get set, go. And they went like this. So we have underlying our culture such a deep win-lose orientation that becomes the only way we see how to approach a problem. And we get locked into it.
Yeah, marvelous, marvelous, marvelous. Now, can you hang on your idea just for a minute? I was scared stiff when he came out in front of the room. I talk, as we've been going along this week, talk about creating learning environments in which people are able to be all they can be. Now, that isn't totally possible in hours' time. For just a moment, what's he going to do? Is he going to use? He's bigger than I am. Is he going to take over here? Scary for a teacher to teach in andragogical ways. When we came in, or some of you weren't here yet, when they're moving the chairs in there, and the temptation to move in competitive, are there more people in there than out here? You know, all those temptations again. But to create what I call safe learning boundaries so that people can be all they can be. Interesting, though, I talked about this with some of my students this spring, and even there the male, female have a different concept of safe. We'll deal with this more on Friday, males and females learning together. Because when I talk about creating safe learning environments, that means so all of us can be all we can be. That some of the men said, if it's a safe learning environment, it must be safe for you and not for me. Safe can only be safe for one. So again, that kind of system of not everybody can win. If you're winning, you're safe, and somebody else is not safe. Permeating our society. Edna, did you still have it? I don't want to lose it. Please. Gladys! Edna's downstairs in our... Yeah, I've got you.
Well, I was just saying, I think it's all in how you perceive yourself. I mean, if you... Some things are competitive to one, which wouldn't be competitive at all to the other person. I mean, it's just within yourself. It's your own feeling about yourself. I'm an overachiever. I'm an overachiever because I can't stand it. Somebody do it better than I can. And if I can't do it better, I don't want to do it.
So even that's very helpful, Gladys, because some of us kind of relish in being non-competitive. Kind of nice. I'm not like all those competitive people. And it's a way for me to stay safe at your expense. You're out there risking. And I'm not even going to try. There can be pride or self-deprecation in both stances.
I'm more non-competitive than you.
Yes, I'm more non-competitive. There you go. Competition can draw people toward violence, hatred, greed, dishonesty, and arrogant pride. The gospel gives freedom to love, to be peaceful, and I would say even to use competition in a creative way. Satisfied, yes, with enough. And there, the whole aspect of greed, 9th and 10th commandment, I think is some things to talk about. Generous, competition is a power that can enslave. The gospel is a power that can free, and I would add, if the gospel is a power that can really free, it can free us perhaps to compete in the sense that some of us have defined it, to compete or not to compete. And perhaps to be selective, I think, again, it is very helpful us to know the uniqueness and the differences among the ways that we learn and are. To be in touch with competition, and for me to say, you've got to compete, would, I think, be very harmful. At the same time, to help someone deal with why it's stressful, or to go back and say, what parts of competition, why don't I like to play Monopoly? Did I get trounced so badly as a child? You know, to unpack some of that, so maybe I'm free to play Monopoly. And working with, maybe with one daughter, it's helpful to figure out what's going on there so the competition need not be a frightening thing. Or with one of my sons to find out why competition is so terribly important. So that, again, it's not just in the identity that I need to be me, but knowing I'm loved enough to be free for competition. And I think that's what he was talking about, to be a servant rather than really to be a master.
What do you do if it's easy to be non-competitive if you're a loser?
If you're a loser? Mm-hmm. If you're a Lutheran?
No, if you're a loser, that it is easier to be non-competitive if you perceive yourself as a loser. The kids in British Columbia who were not competing in sport were those that had lost out by being second graders, and already somebody had tossed them aside. And there's all kinds of evidence that they quit in sport, which is, you know, the pinnacle of competition, for better or for worse. But that then, as the winners look and perceive, then they're double losers because they're not competitive, because it's easier to be, for you to say, as you have said, say, well, what can you do with it? How can you get rid of the circle?
The whole Black pride, I am somebody, you see. I mean, it's just terribly important, and that relates to identity and freeing up to really be, to be what we are. I think the whole a couple years ago I had to struggle with. There was a lot of winning that was going on in my life, and it became a really hard psychological problem for me to deal with. I was winning and other people were losing, and part of me wanted them to lose real bad. And I finally had to deal with it. It would not help them if I lost, if I threw the game, so to say. I think we could do a lot of work on a theology of Christians being all that they can be and of winning for the sake of others. Certainly, well, the class a couple years ago, the pedagogy of the non-poor, does not help the poor for us to say, oh, we're not that rich. It doesn't help for us to deny, to call unclean what God has called clean, to deny the gifts that we have, to lose when we could win. Lots of other questions that peel off of that. Yeah.
Well, in a family, if you have an older brother or sister who always is best, it's too hard to be important or significant competing with them. So often that person becomes significant by being the loser, yep, by being the worst.
Yep. I will be the bad child, huh? That's second best to being the good child. At least I get some recognition.
Yep.
This raises more questions, huh, than it answers. Isn't nice and neat? I didn't finish up point 7 of the lecture for you. Some other things on your head you wanted before we need to scatter to go eat that are it. Again, I'm kind of thinking ahead toward next week when we deal with American civil religion, and it's my thesis that the public school is a symbol of and a place to pass on American civil religion in our society. And there are two different faiths that we live by. If I live in a society as a Christian, and it's important to kind of distinguish those and to figure them out, because our society is based on, we do live in a competitive society. And with that fact, then it raises important questions about what we do when we come together as a Christian learning community.
You're putting the load on the schools. Don't you think it starts in the homes?
Well, the home is all part of, I mean, everything that we do, because we live in this milieu, is a competitive kind of thing. I'm just saying that that's one place where we kind of focus and come together in a public way.
And I think that actually in school makes a lot add stress to the home where you see this, and then you have to, you know, reassure and put a lot more into that child. A
lot of competition that goes on in our homes too, mm-hmm. as you just said.
My kid sat up at 5 months. My kid rolled over at 4 months. My kid could walk at 10 months.
My kid could not walk till he was 18 months. What's wrong with your kid? He's walking around here now real well. He knew when he could walk. He had very small feet and a big body. He knew when he was ready to walk. And it was 18 months. Maybe that's a good note on which to end. Okay. Good. We'll go eat. Thank you.